Hi everyone, this is Kim.
Hey Kim, this is Daniel Hardman. I just wanted to check to make sure my audio's working.
Oh great, yes it is. I'm glad you did because I was also wondering if mine's working. I've been having a lot of ear or whatever they're called. iPod, iPod, I don't know. Yeah. But they seem to be working, so it's good. Okay, let me go ahead and get started. Okay, this is the link to the agenda. And today's highlights, we're going to be talking about ZKP Primer, and Daniel Hardman has joined us for that. Let's see. So the overview, how this will go down, we'll do the boilerplate stuff, call notes at the beginning, pick a scribe, introductions, reintroductions, announcements and reminders, progress on action items. Then we'll have Balazs, hopefully from DIF, to talk about the DIF W3C agreement that's in place so we can start collaborating on the, I think it was called Data Storage Super Friends or something like that, basically where we work on identity hubs, encrypted data vaults, et cetera. And then the main part of the presentation will be, of this call, will be Daniel Hardman. And I'll go ahead and point you to the slide link that he has. I'll repaste that later on. Okay, let me go ahead and get started. Okay, IP note, anyone can participate in these calls. However, all substantive contributors to any CCG work items must be members of the CCG with full IPR agreement signed. And to join the credentials community group, here is the link right here. You may, if not already, need to get a W3C account. And the link for that is here. I'm pasting in IRC. And then lastly, the W3C Community Contributor License Agreement, if you want to read the text before going through all of this, is available here. Call notes. These minutes and an audio recording of everything said on this call are archived at the following link that I paste into IRC. We use IRC to cue speakers during the call as well as to take minutes. And speak up if you don't know, if you need information about getting to the IRC channel. All attendees should type present plus to get your name on the attendee list in the transcript so you can see other people doing it, but basically it's the word present, the symbol plus immediately following, no space in between, and you'll be on the attendee list in the transcript. If you're new to the call, make sure that you write in your full name because we do need to associate new aliases with actual people to get it properly accounted for. So if you write your, we'll know your alias. So just in IRC, write your name and, even better, link to your website or LinkedIn profile or Twitter account or something so we know who you are. Okay, we use IRC to cue speakers during the call as well as to take minutes. Oh, I said that. in IRC, type Q+, the letter Q, the symbol plus, no space in between, to add yourself to the queue with optional reminder. For example, Q+, to mention that the DID spec needs more work, and the word to is required. If you're not on IRC, simply ask to be put on the queue. And please be brief so the rest of the queue can get a chance to chime in. You can always queue plus again. Okay, now we're looking for a volunteer to scribe. Anyone want to volunteer? Okay, so I'm going to start going through the list of attendees that list of scribes that I pasted here. Filtering out people who I don't see on the alias list as being present. So Jeff Orgel, are you able to scribe? Okay. Ganesh Anand? Again, looking for, oh, great. Thank you so much, Ganesh. I will move you to the back so that we don't call on you in the near future. Thanks again. Let's see what we have next. Okay, introductions and reintroductions. Anyone new to the call that wants to introduce themselves, either add yourself to the queue or you can just speak up.
Yeah, this is John St. John. I'm an engineer at Anonymy Labs in Salt Lake City, Utah, joining for the first time.
Great. Thanks for joining us. Looking to see if there are any new aliases I don't recognize. Let's see. So let me get to the reintroduction list. Dimitri, are you on the call? And if so, can you reintroduce yourself? For some reason, I think that we may have called on you recently, but maybe we didn't update the accounting. But if not, can you introduce yourself? Okay, let me keep going through. If Heather Vesson, I don't see her here. Ganesh, would you like to reintroduce yourself? I'll scribe for you.
Perfect. That works. Yes, my name is Ganesh. I am a program manager at Digital Bazaar, and I do everything from gathering requirements for engineering tasks for our engineering department, as well as implementing a lot of the standards-based products around verifiable credentials in Digital.
Great. Thanks for joining us, Ganesh. Okay, I think I got that. Let me make sure I moved you around. Okay, so you're off the hook for reintroductions for a while as well. Okay, let's move on to announcements and reminders in just a second while I get this up. Okay, some of these are probably affected by recent happenings. So here's a link. We try to keep this up to date, but I actually just got an email this morning saying that no identity has been postponed. So let's see. Actually, so starting with rebooting Web of Trust, which is happening in theory soon, well, not really. It's apparently they're puzzling through a virtual event. I'll send a link to that. Christopher, I don't know if you're here, but if you or anyone who knows about what's going on there can talk about what's going on with rebooting and the virtual meeting. And Adrian, I'll call on you right after that. I think Joe's on the queue to talk to that.
Yeah. We are not going to be doing a virtual meeting because of the time frame in which we needed to make a decision and the engagement we got from folks. It just didn't make sense. We didn't think we could pull it off with the level of quality that we wanted.
Great. Thank you. And Adrian, actually, I'll go ahead and call on you.
Okay. Quickly, I'm trying to see if there's other people in the group that are interested in thinking through what an app, an official app would look like to help with pandemic mitigation, contact tracing, you know, reducing the impact of self-isolation. So I put a link in the chat that people should look at it. It's a rebooting discourse link or should contact me directly. Thanks.
Thank you, Adrian. And continuing to work through the announcements, no identity has been postponed, if you didn't know that already. So that was going to be April 5th through 8th in Vegas, but that is not happening now. Internet Identity Workshop has not been canceled yet. That is currently listed as 28th through 30th of April. I'll include the link to that. We'll see what happens there.
I think the key word in that sentence is yet.
Okay. Okay, thanks, Kalia. And then Identiverse, similarly, has not been canceled yet. It's currently listed as 8th through 11th of June. And I'll add myself to the queue. So, I live in, or I am ACK myself. So I live in Seattle, and things are pretty crazy around here. It's really strange. Being nosy, I started poking around to see, like, how can a developer help? Because, we don't get to be first responders. But I found that the Seattle Flu Study and Next Strain group, they are the tools that they use to conduct real-time COVID-19 outbreak response for the Seattle epidemic. They use GitHub. And so I reached out to the lead developer on that. And so I do have an issue I got just today. And so if anyone wants to participate in a more, I'll call it a more humble way, I expect it to be kind of low level, like helping them get their act to, they have a lot of stuff they're trying to make sense of. And also I think they're kind of dealing with, the idea of how do you deal with people who are trying to figure out how to help, but then there's that communication strain. So in my free time, I'm trying to help, where I can to get their sort of, at least starting with their documentation and deploying and stuff like that to make some of the processes more seamless. So if you want to jump in with me on that issue, let me know, because it certainly feels more useful than refreshing Twitter and seeing what's happening. So you can chime in on, you can look at their GitHub directly or email me if you want to coordinate on that. Let's see. Okay, so progress on action items. Let me get that link. And I think we may not have a lot to talk about here, but please add yourself if you have anything you want to report out. Let's see. Okay. Closing out the digital verification community group. Anyone have anything they want to share on this? We've noticed a lot of activities, so I think we're just dealing with stuff like GitHub redirections or website redirections, things like that. I don't know if Dimitri is here. It's currently assigned to him. Ori, you're up.
Yeah. So if you have an item that's in the DVCG and it's really valuable and you want to keep it and you want to get active contribution or help move it, the sooner that organization has basically no active repos in it, the sooner we will be through the migration process. So please review the repos that are there, leave comments on them. For pretty much every repo that's in that group, you should open an issue that says deprecate or archive and or move to an appropriate housing location. If the community could help and encourage that approach, I think we will get things moved over faster.
Okay, that sounds good. Thank you. Let me make a quick note on the main issue. Okay, thank you, Ori. That was actually all I had in the action items, so I think we can go ahead and move on to a part. Actually, oh, Blaz is here. Blaz, you are up next to talk about our exciting announcement.
Hi, everyone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Ah, perfect. So we came to the agreement between W3C and the Decentralized Identity Foundation that DIF is going to be able to, very, very likely now it seems, able to host the Secure Data Storage Working Group, which is going to be a joint working group between W3C, CCG, and DIF. And in relation to that, our first scoping call, which is primarily going to focus about giving an update in the last couple of months, happening in the background, as well as start the work around creating a scope for the working group in the format of a non-IPR protected call. I will copy in a link to the IRC chat where folks can sign up to the call. It's on Friday, 12 p.m. Eastern Summer Time, or 5 p.m. CET, or the other time zones. So everyone who is interested and attended the Super Friends call, we could call it the third Super Friends call. It's going to have the same sort of goals to establish the working group, but now we have the sort of legal backing that was missing back in December. And we are very, very excited to finally very soon kick off the work and make sure now that we are all aligned what is the work items that has to be delivered by this working group.
Thank you for that. Does anyone have any questions about that? Actually, did we send out, I thought I noticed you sent out an announcement about the call on Friday already. Did you mention that already? Sorry.
Yes, Friday I sent out maybe a bit too late, so I'm actually happy to send a follow-up. I also just copied in the link to the form that can be used.
Great, thank you for that. So yes, if you fill that out, it will send you a calendar invite. So yeah, that's exciting. We can keep moving forward on the Super Friends discussion. Okay, I don't see any questions, so I think we can move on to the next part, and that will be the ZKP primer with Daniel Hardman. Just one second while I get some bookkeeping out of the way. So I'm going to send a link to his slides. And Daniel, do you prefer to manage the queue, basically like pace yourself with the presentation, or would you rather me just interrupt now and then if I see the queue building up?
I'd like you to interrupt because it's hard for me to manage both of those at the same time.
I completely understand. Okay, that's perfect. Okay, so I'll turn over to you to get started.
Okay, great. So the presentation that I'm going to be speaking from has numbers on the slides, and so I'll be referring to the slide numbers as I go. The first slide I'm talking on is numbered slide 2, and that's the agenda. So I just want to make sure everybody understands what my intention is about what I want to cover. I want to talk about what the definition of a zero-knowledge proof is and give some examples. I'd like to talk about the differences between zero-knowledge proofs and credentials that are zero-knowledge proof-oriented. I think sometimes in conversations we casually conflate those two, and pulling them apart might be helpful. I'd like to talk about the goals of zero-knowledge credentials and how they are related to linked secrets. And lastly, and importantly, I'd like to talk about where zero-knowledge proof-oriented credentials don't make sense. So that's the agenda, 5 basic topics, and I'm hoping we can get through all of these. Kim, I'm assuming we want to leave time for Q&A, but if I speak for most of the remaining time, is that okay?
Yeah, if you give it like 15 minutes for Q&A, ideally, so that would be like 25 minutes. And I want to check, I think Ganesh just asked if you're on IRC. I didn't see your alias here.
I'm not on IRC right now.
Okay, that's fine. We'll find a way. Thanks. Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm on slide 3. I'm beginning the section of the presentation that's about the definition and some examples. So right now, just to be clear, what I'm defining is zero-knowledge proofs, not zero-knowledge proof credentials. And there's a whole section about why that's a different topic. But the definition of zero-knowledge proofs that's on the screen on slide 4 is the canonical definition. This is the definition from the seminal academic paper that introduced the concept. You will find other definitions online in various places, and there are reasons why you will find definitions that don't match this exactly, and I'm going to talk about those in a second. But this is the definition. Zero-knowledge proofs are defined as those proofs that convey no additional knowledge other than the correctness of the proposition in question. So the zeroness here is about the zeroness in a delta between what you're trying to prove and what you actually prove. It's not about proving nothing. That would be silly, right? So anyway, this is very similar to the principle of least privilege in cybersecurity, where you say you don't want to give any more privileges than what you actually have to give. But with zero-knowledge proofs, it's you don't want to give any more information than you actually have to give. Now, the next slide, slide 6, is about the formal definition. And let me explain why there's a difference between a formal definition and the simple one that I just read. If you look at the red text at the bottom of this slide, what you'll find is a brilliant cryptographer explaining why they need a formal definition. The notion that nothing extra is learned is a very hard notion to explain mathematically. And so the formal definition that mathematicians and cryptographers use is actually framed in terms of a thought experiment. The thought experiment imagines that you emit messages that go back and forth in particular ways, and it focuses in on the properties of what you can learn from those messages. And that's an important definition, and it's a true definition, but it's not the definition that I read to you first. So the reason why these two different things exist is one is about what mathematicians are confident they can represent in formal notation and with Turing machines and so forth. That's the formal thing. The other is kind of the ideal and simple and very approachable human definition, which is simply don't leak anything extra. And there are differences between these two definitions. Let me go to slide 6. Slide 6 is a Venn diagram that shows the set of things, propositions, or whatever, that are kind of addressable by different imagined definitions of zero-knowledge proofs. So the inner circle here is primitive zero-knowledge proofs of knowledge. That's a subset of zero-knowledge proofs, and it's about proving one fact. And when in casual conversations you hear people talking about something like prove you're over 21, that's a one-fact zero-knowledge proof. At least if you look at it very simplistically, it is. It turns out that you actually have to prove multiple things to satisfy that proof. But anyway, the simplistic one-fact version of a zero-knowledge proof of knowledge is the innermost circle here. Then there's an outer circle, a bit bigger, that is systems of zero-knowledge proofs of knowledge. And if you've heard of ZK snarks and stuff, that's the scope of those things. Okay, and then there's an even bigger circle, which is the set of things that is implied by the original classic definition of zero-knowledge proofs, but is not implied by the formal definition, because mathematicians aren't sure yet how to reduce the bigger circle, or the delta between the biggest and the second biggest circle. They're not sure how to do a formalization of certain kinds of things, okay? So sometimes when people talk about what is possible with zero-knowledge proofs, they're talking about the inner circle. Sometimes they're talking about the next biggest circle. Sometimes they're talking about the outermost circle. And I have repeatedly run into people in digital identity circles who are talking about a different circle than the one that somebody next to them is talking about. And this is a source of much confusion, in my opinion. So I'm hoping that this focus on definitions for a minute will help us get really crisp. On to slide 7. This is the classic definition, or the classic explanation of zero-knowledge proofs that you run into if you go read the Wikipedia article. There's a thought experiment where Alice goes into a cave. Bob is on the outside of the cave. Actually, Victor, because Victor is the verifier. Anyway, Victor's on the outside of the cave. Alice goes down one of the two branches of the cave. At the back of the cave, there's a door that only opens with a password, and Alice is trying to prove that she knows the password. So once Alice is inside the cave, Victor goes to the mouth of the cave, and he calls and says to her, "Hey, come out branch A of the cave," and Alice comes out. And then he repeats this experiment lots of times, sometimes asking her to come out of branch A, sometimes out of branch B, and Alice always comes out whatever branch he demands. Excuse me, I'm getting an interruption here. Okay, so the point I'm trying to make here is that this is called a zero-knowledge proof in the sense that what Alice proves to Victor is that she knows the password, but she never tells him what the password is. He just becomes confident that she knows it because of her behavior. And we call that zero knowledge, but there's an important hedge word around this, and that's the word approximately. If you go back to the slide 5 and read the text by Yehuda Lindell there, a world-class cryptographer, he uses that word approximately. He says that the difference between the simulator in the thought experiment in the formal definition and the real version of things is they can both learn approximately the same amount of information. So what I'm trying to emphasize here is that there's no illusion here when we build zero-knowledge proofs that of perfection. We're approximately perfect. Some things that you could learn from this classic thought experiment: Victor could learn that Peggy is not deaf. That wasn't technically part of what Peggy was trying to prove. All she was trying to prove is that she knew the password. But that information leaks out of the zero-knowledge proof. But we don't really say this is a bad zero-knowledge proof because of that leakage, because we would say that it's still approximately the same amount. Victor probably has reasons to believe Peggy's not deaf anyway before the experiment started. Let me pause here for just a minute and make sure that no large questions have accumulated before I go on.
No, it's an empty queue, and I think this is a group. Oh, can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, the queue is empty. And this is a great example, by the way.
Okay, good. So now I'm going to give you some really simple real-world examples. Slide 8 is a picture of the graphic that's displayed on the body scanners by TSA in the United States. And this is effectively a zero-knowledge proof. When you walk into that scanner and you hold your arms the way they want you to, and they run a little thing, they are very deliberately suppressing certain kinds of information, trying to make sure that they don't leak. So they're not trying to tell anybody, the people who are reviewing the scan or the people who are standing in line around you, what your height and weight are, what your nude body looks like, what style of underwear you wear and or the lack thereof, whether you've had a mastectomy or a colostomy or a prosthesis, whether you're pregnant. They're trying to suppress all of that information and answer a single question. Person X is concealing nothing, yes or no. And so it's interesting to think about that particular proof and why it has been made zero knowledge. Why did the public want this particular experience of being scanned at an airport not to include a picture of their nude body, not to include all this other information? And what did the government have to agree to, and what did the technology have to provide to turn that into a zero-knowledge proof? Just food for thought on that particular example. Let me go to the next example. This is slide 9. Slide 9 shows a picture of actual HIV test results. And the way that these test results for this particular test are displayed, there is a negative control line, a positive control line, and then there's a line for a test subject. And it's the comparison between the positive and negative controls and the test subject results that tells you whether or not the person has a positive HIV result. So this is another example of a real-world test that meets the no additional knowledge criterion. Excuse me. It's not leaking the PII of subject 0224. It's not leaking any other diagnoses. It's not leaking whether the subject is currently using prescription or illicit drugs. It's not leaking their financial or insurance information. It's simply answering one proposition, whether or not test subject 0224 is HIV positive. Let me go on to an example that might raise some eyebrows. This is number 10, slide 10. Again, we're applying the standard of no additional knowledge here. So the picture on the slide is a picture of an application for a mortgage. And if you look carefully at the picture, it's asking for things like your date of birth, the full name of the borrower and the co-borrower, how many dependents live in the home, what your phone number is, what your social security number is, must be a United States mortgage. But anyway, could that be a zero knowledge proof? Well, what is the proposition? The proposition is all of the data that's required of the borrower. What is not part of the home loan? Well, there's a big long list of things, and many of these are actually mandated by law. It's illegal in the United States anyway, and I think in many other legal jurisdictions, to ask what the race of the borrower is. It's illegal to ask what the religion of the borrower is, what their national origin is, what their disability status is, so forth. It's illegal to ask if they're pregnant or they're planning to start a family. It's illegal to ask whether the borrower receives public welfare assistance. So, to the extent that you have a home loan application form that is exactly congruent with the requirements for borrowing and not leaking anything extra, it meets the definition of a zero-knowledge proof as given on slide 4, the classic definition. Those proofs that convey no additional knowledge other than the correctness of the proposition in question. I have heard a number of people use home mortgages as an example of, well, we don't want zero-knowledge proofs in those cases, and that's a misconception. We do want zero-knowledge proofs in those cases. It's just that the scope of what we're proving is much bigger. Okay, another one. Slide 11, this is a picture of a dog sniffing around in lockers, and the dog is a police dog that's looking for illicit drugs. Again, the proposition here is that there are no illegal drugs in the locker. The things that are excluded by this style of zero-knowledge proof are whether somebody in one of their lockers has legal drugs, whether they're using particular shampoo or they have perfume or deodorant or whatever. All of that stuff is excluded from the concern. Who left their lunch in the locker contrary to policy is not something that the dog has been trained to provide information about. So the dog has been very carefully trained to essentially provide a zero-knowledge proof of the presence or non-presence of illegal drugs. Slide 12. So just to reemphasize here, the requirements, not the technique that you use and not the amount that you prove, is what determines whether or not the proof that you're using is zero knowledge. Okay? So let me give you two examples. One is a non-ZKP proof, and one is a true ZKP proof. And hopefully these two examples will make this really clear. So the first one is, let's prove that you're over 21, exactly and only that you're over 21, using really sophisticated cryptographic key signature schemes and all kinds of fancy stuff, and using zero-knowledge proof-oriented credentials. But the proposition you were supposed to prove is that you were over 18. You've proved what you needed to, but you've actually proved a little bit more, because now the age range that you were supposed to provide is actually more constrained than you were being asked for. That is not a zero-knowledge proof, no matter what technique you're using, and no matter how you do it and what style of credential you're using to do it. On the other hand, if you're being asked to disclose your name, your birth date, your public DID value, your bank account number, your passport number, your fingerprints, your full credit history, and your entire genome, that could be a zero-knowledge proof if, and only if, that's exactly the requirements. So let me emphasize this in one other way as well, and then we'll be done with the definition section. Slide 13. This is a classic kind of a real-world interesting proof. Prove your name from your passport. And by the way, your passport has to be issued by Nation X, you know, Canada or France or something. So if that's the requirements, I have heard people say, well, that can't be a zero-knowledge proof because your name is an identifier. It can be a zero-knowledge proof, and there's a difference between how a zero-knowledge proof would address these requirements and how a non-zero-knowledge proof would address them. A zero-knowledge proof would say, okay, there's two facts that are part of the proposition. Fact one is, my name is Alice Jones, so I'm going to disclose that fact because I was asked to do so. Fact two is that France signed fact one. So I have to prove that France signed fact one. Now, if I can do exactly and only that, I have accomplished zero knowledge. But if I show them being the verifier, if I actually show them the signature, instead of proving that the signature exists and was applied by France, then I have leaked an additional fact, which is the value of the signature. So if I show them the value of the signature, as opposed to proving that the signature came from France, I have leaked something, and I've gone beyond the bounds of zero knowledge. Any questions on this part before I go on to phase two?
I do. I don't know about the queue, but I thought I'd jump in.
Actually, we have Dave Longley on the queue.
You can go first, Joe. Okay. That's fine.
I was just going to – so earlier, Daniel, you established this idea of approximately zero as appropriate. Isn't the signature information basically zero?
No, the signature information is much, much bigger than zero because it allows me to be correlated perfectly in every use.
Okay. Thanks.
And Dave is up next.
Yeah, I was gonna have a similar question, which was, there seems to be a tension here with what approximately means. So in some cases, you know, if your name, for example, is very specific, if your name is Alice Jones, there might be many more Alice Jones in the world. But if your name is, you know, Chidi Agonye, for example, you might be the only one. And under those circumstances, the term approximately seems to play a role here, since the signature value and the name carry the same level of information. And so I'm curious if there's a certain tension that needs to be taken into consideration when using this sort of technology. And then I've got another follow-on question after that.
Yes, there's a slide a little bit later on. Let me direct you to it. You can go look at it ahead of time if you want. Let me find it. It is slide 24, Dave, that kind of addresses that a little bit, and I'll get there eventually. Maybe we can talk about it more when I get to that slide.
Sure. So my other question had to do with in the zero-knowledge literature, there's a distinction made between zero-knowledge arguments and zero-knowledge proofs, and I'm just curious about what you're intending to cover here, because you did mention ZK Stark, ZK Snark. Those are zero-knowledge arguments, which are different from zero-knowledge proofs. Zero-knowledge proofs are they give you computational zero knowledge, which means as long as someone's computer is not able to break the proof that you've made, or as long as there's no quantum computer involved, then you are not leaking additional knowledge. But if someone does have that sort of computational power, then you are in fact leaking additional information, and your proof can be effectively cracked in the future or with enough computational power. And I'm curious to know if all this, the slide deck so far only talks about zero knowledge proofs, and the literature there says we're talking about computational zero knowledge. Do you mean to include in this presentation zero knowledge argument, which were statistically or perfectly zero knowledge, even if you have, they're not computationally bound. So even if you were able to build a quantum computer, you would not be able to break the knowledge. And I'm curious if you are intending to talk about both here or not.
So if you go back to my first couple of slides, I gave you an informal definition and I gave you a formal one. And the thing that you're talking about is a distinction that's made by people who are doing formal definition work. It is not a distinction that's made in the original canonical definition of zero-knowledge proofs. So when you have people wag your fingers and say, that's not a zero-knowledge proof, they're living in formal definition land. There's nothing wrong with living in formal definition land, but the next section of my presentation is about which of these definitions is intended in zero-knowledge proof-oriented credentials. So maybe I can go on to that and it will become clear, but the short answer is ZK-SNARKs and other things like it are part of what zero-knowledge credentials include. So I am talking about zero-knowledge proofs in the non-formal sense, and I'm including in it zero-knowledge arguments and other things like it, as long as they meet the original canonical definition of zero-knowledge proof. So let me go on to this thing about the credential types, if that's okay, unless the queue's really big. Is that okay,
Kim? Oh, no, this,
Kim?
It's empty now. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the second part of this presentation is about the difference between zero-knowledge proofs and zero-knowledge credentials. This is slide 14, but really slide 15. Slide 15 is a diagram that shows the relationship between these a little bit and calls out some, but not all, of the subtleties to keep in mind about how this is a difference. Let me just talk my way through the diagram at the bottom of slide 15. So what we have on the left side of the diagram at the bottom is one or more zero-knowledge proof-oriented credentials. these are credentials like the ones that are issued in Sovereign Ecosystem where I live, or like are issued by the ABC for Trust stuff, or like are built by the Microsoft research team who has been interested in UProof and related technologies for a long time, or like are done with IDEMIX that was built by IBM Research. These types of credentials are held by somebody, and then when somebody interacts with the holder and says, hey, I would like to request that you present something to me, the material in the ZKP-oriented credential is used to generate a ZKP or a zero knowledge proof. And you'll notice on the diagram that the proof has two different stamps, official stamps on it, where the original credential only had one. The proof here could include material from more than one of the source credentials, and it could include a lot less material than either of the source credentials had in it. Whatever is put into that proof, though, it's colored green to kind of resonate with slide 12, where I was using green to show that the proper scope of the proposition in question. So if the proposition in question is, you know, prove that your name is, I'm Dave, I apologize, but whatever that cool name is that you articulated, your unique name. Yeah, if that's the proposition, prove that that's your name and it appears on a passport that was signed by France. If that's your proposition, then that's the stuff that's green here. And then that proof is wrapped in the formatting of the W3C verifiable credential and presentation standard, such that what you get in the end is a presentation that contains inside it a just-in-time credential, if you will, that contains just the material used to prove the proposition at issue. And so if you look at the bullets up above, the things that are a little bit different here, the credentials on the left are signed in a special way, and there's some reasons why they have to be signed in a special way. The credentials on the left are not shown directly to verifiers. Rather, what's shown in every case is a just-in-time derivation of the credentials at the left. And the specific thing that I think is often missed and misunderstood here is the credentials at the left have no meaningful credential ID property. I don't remember whether the verifiable credential data model requires a credential ID. If it does, it's fine. We can put one in there. But the credential ID property in the credentials at the left is never actually revealed to anybody, so it doesn't matter. And this is where the term anonymous credentials comes from, and there's a big misunderstanding around this. Anonymous credentials do not mean anonymous people. They mean anonymous credentials. That is, there is no identifier for the credential itself. Okay? The last bullet there, these credentials may or may not have an ID property for subject equals holder. That gets into the topic of linked secrets, which we'll talk about a little bit later. The credential on the right, the green credential that's inside the presentation, is also a credential according to the verifiable credentials data model. But when people who work on ZKP-oriented credentials talk about the credential or the credential that you hold or a ZKP credential, they're always talking about the credentials on the left, the ones that get issued. The ones that end up getting presented are throwaway, and we don't usually think of them as credentials, although they are by the technical definition. We think of them just as presentations or proofs. So sometimes when people talk about ZKP credentials, they might be talking about the stuff at the right. If they are, they're probably not going to be talking about the same subject as ZKP proponents who are talking about the stuff at the left. Any questions about this diagram before I go on?
No, and just a time check, we're at 9 minutes.
Okay, thanks. So I'm going to skip to slide 17. What are the actual goals of ZKP-oriented credentials? And I'm going to give you these goals in approximate priority order. So slide 17, the first and most important goal of a ZKP-oriented credential is one credential with many perfectly fitted presentations. The diagram that's here is a single credential, and on the right side of the diagram are bunches of different profiles of facts, green facts, where every single presentation that you come up with exactly matches the circumstances you're trying to address. So that's the most important goal of ZKP-oriented credentials. You could also call it perfect selective disclosure. That has always been the most important goal. Anonymity is sometimes asserted as a goal, but you notice that that's not the first goal that I started with. And that's deliberate, and it's true. Anonymity is not the primary goal of zero-knowledge credentials. Okay, goal two is also not anonymity. Goal two is to eliminate phone home for revocation. I'm on slide 18. Okay. When you need to test whether or not a credential is revoked, we want it to be the case that you don't have to go back to the issuer to test that. Slide 19 is about another form of phone home that we also are trying to eliminate, which is phone home for just-in-time issuance. With zero-knowledge proofs, what we're trying to do is say, we'll give you, let's say, your driver's license, and all the different variations on the facts in your driver's license, you yourself as a holder can generate all those variations without having to go back and ask the issuer again to help you or cooperate. Now, slide 20 is just very simple, but this is really important. So I've given you three goals on slide 17, 18, and 19. None of them have the word anonymity in them. Okay. 20 and 21 are the consequences or the kind of the indirect goals that we're trying to get at by doing the direct goals of slides 17, 18, and 19. So the first indirect goal is we want to enable barriers to unreasonable visibility. Okay. And there's a picture of a toilet here because with a door on it, this is a good analogy of what we're trying to do. When you use the bathroom, you go in and you close the door, you're not trying to be anonymous. What you're trying to do is be private, and there's a big difference. And the difference is unreasonable visibility versus not knowing your identity. And I feel a little bit frustrated sometimes by the assertions that I have heard that what we're trying to do is accomplish anonymity. The second goal, slide 21, is to enable offline. By subtracting the issuer from all calculations, all these phone home things, what we're trying to do is allow a holder and a verifier to operate where the issuer is unavailable. The issuer might be unavailable because the issuer went out of business. They could be unavailable because they're offline. They could be unavailable because the holder and the verifier are offline. But in any case, having the flexibility to present credentials and achieve trust without the issuer being there to facilitate is helpful. So slide 22 is about the standards for deciding what's acceptable. Who decides what is acceptable proof? And to some extent, this gets at Dave's earlier question, is it okay to disclose a name when the name is highly identifying and so forth? Well, the answer is the verifier decides. If the verifier says you must disclose your name no matter whether it's Alice Jones or it's something really highly identifying, then that's that. you have to satisfy the verifier or you walk away from the interaction. So whatever the standards are, the verifier decides them. If Alice is buying a house, a reasonable standard would probably be to demand a lot of PII, and Alice should provide it. On the other hand, if Alice is going to a rock concert, it's probably not reasonable for the party that's running the rock concert to need to know the name and phone number and home address of every person who walks through the door. It's probably more reasonable to say, just prove to me that you're using a ticket that hasn't been consumed before and the rest is uninteresting to me. So what we hope is that verifiers pick reasonable standards, and we'd like those standards to have reputations, which is part of the reason why proof requests and things like them need to be published in, like, trust frameworks so that people can say, this is a reasonable amount of information to demand when you're enrolling as a new, customer of a doctor. This is a reasonable amount of information to demand when you're enrolling as a new customer at Starbucks. And those probably are different. Now, one of the things that's often brought up in relation to ZKPs is that, and I'm on slide 23 now, we're not going to get through this. Basically, ZKPs shift something. They shift when disclosure happens. They don't necessarily change how much disclosure happens overall, but the value of privacy changes over time, and the difficulty of maintaining private information changes over time. And ZKPs are about shifting that. That's what slide 23 is about. 24 that Dave asked about is pointing out that context often changes how much anonymity you could achieve. And there's a picture here of Christina Koch, an astronaut, who is on the International Space Station. If the proof that you gave to a particular person, the proof request was, prove you're less than 42 years old, and you had done it on December 9th, 2019 on the International Space Station, that would be a uniquely identifying proof because Christina Koch was the only astronaut on the International Space Station on that day who was less than 42 years old. On the other hand, if you prove that in other contexts, it might not be identifying at all. So the real goal here is what's shown on this curve. There is this phenomenon that Dave has talked about that he calls the trust paradox, where you have to be vulnerable. But we're not trying to achieve absolute anonymity. What we're trying to do, given the context and other factors which we can't avoid, like the fact that sometimes there's circumstances that leak other information, is to achieve reasonable privacy and good trust, acknowledging what is going to be influenced by other factors. So I didn't get a chance to talk about the link secret things, and our time is up. What do you want to do, Kim?
Yeah, well, thank you. I think this is a great overview, and like you said, there are some follow-up topics that we wanted to talk about. So I think that maybe we'll invite you back for continued discussion. I know that we had talked about issues around in the mailing list around chain delegation and things like that, and I'm personally interested in hearing more about link secrets. So thank you for joining us, and thanks, everyone. And we look forward to having Daniel back on a future call to continue this discussion. Thanks, everyone.